This tape is the debrief of Colonel D.E. Lowndes, 015530, by Colonel R.H. Mample, 040489, at headquarters FMF PAC, 29 July 1968. The tape covers events from August 1967 to April 1968. The classification is secret.
Book and try to keep it at that level, really. The Quezon Combat Base, I suppose if you went back in retrospect and you took how it was chosen to defend it and put it on a map right now and took it back to basic school probably, and certainly in junior and senior school, people would thought I'd lost my marbles. Because the thing happened kind of peculiar in a way. I guess in some ways not as peculiar as you might think, because of the fact that in any combat situation, you deal with the situation as it evolves. I've been asked many times, if I had to defend it different, would I change anything? And the way it developed, I don't know that I would. I probably would move one battalion further off the end of the airstrip than it was, to give me some advantage of some high ground. I had intended to do this originally, because I had trouble getting the Arvin to move. I never did accomplish it before we got fairly well hemmed in. I think I started off saying that if you took it and made a map study of it, it probably would never be defended the way that it was defended. And the reason that it was defended the way it was is that, as many of you probably know, it started off as a one battalion show. I was a battalion commander, really, or a supervisor of a battalion commander. And then as the threat grew, the forces grew. As a matter of fact, at one particular point, I got a call from the division that said, I'm sending 226 back to you. And I said, when? And they said, look up in the sky and you'll probably see him coming in. And that was just about the way it was. I think within 5 minutes, I went from the CP to the airstrip to greet the battalion commander. And I didn't wait there 5 minutes, and it was there. Consequently, although we had thought about it, and we had a pretty good idea where we wanted to defend, it was done on a moment's notice. In other words, other than the one battalion which was already in position, the new forces came in fairly rapid succession. As you probably know, the press in some cases was a little bit critical of the way that we were prepared. However, I think the thing that they forgot or refused to take cognizance of was the fact that we had prepared positions for one battalion. We didn't have prepared positions for five battalions, which I ended up with. Consequently, when they first came up there, there were people who didn't have 7-foot trenches and didn't have overhead cover. And I think that the comment was a little bit unjustified that we weren't ready. The units came in on a moment's notice, and we put them best we could. Relative to the defensive position, as time grew, and we tried to follow the individual handbook and prepare our defenses in accordance with standard doctrine. In other words, you build hasty defenses, and then you work up to make them more stable, and then you get in wire, you get in your hasty wire first, then you get in your fixed wire, then you get in your minefields, and we were building, and we built it all the time, and by the time that 30 days had gone by, we had everybody, if they didn't want to, soon had trenches that were 6 and 7 foot deep, and General Tompkins is a strong advocate of wire, and well, I guess around within 30 days, around most of the positions, we had at least six layers of wire, either a triple concertina or a double barbed wire apron fence, double apron fences. And we kept on building. Every day, if we could, we put more wire out. And then we proceeded with our minefields, and we built those. Another point I think probably of interest is is the fact that we people came by Quezon, and they said, how come these bunkers aren't built to withstand greater artillery shells? I mean, you know, larger calibers. And in my original defenses, my guidance from my artillery people and FSCC had told me that if I had steel planking and two layers of sandbags, I could take 82s. And so the initial overhead cover, and also the intent was and was followed, that every man would have overhead cover, either in a fighting hole or a bunker, and that the fighting holes would have the steel planking and two layers of sandbags to withstand the 82, which they did, incidentally. The guidance that I got from my people was definitely sound. The steel matting and the two layers of sandbags will take an 82, and nobody in the fighting hole or the bunker will be hurt. But then comes a point of how thick do you make your emplacements? What type shells are you going to be able to withstand? And this would be a good problem for somebody as to what are you going to do. I, as a commander, chose that we'd take the 82, and then if we had time, we'd build to bigger bunkers and so forth. If I had it to do over again, I'm not so sure, except to keep the men busy and occupied, that I would go any greater than for the 82, because when the rocket comes in, you just almost can't build it thick enough to stop that 122 rocket. And I built a new CP bunker, because I didn't think the one I had would never got to live in it, incidentally. But I built a new CP bunker, and it was built according to the what's the name of that new line they're putting in? It was according to the die marker specifications, anyway. And being conservative and having taken about 2 days before about 1,300 rounds, I decided that one layer, like they said, which was enough to protect you against the artillery, wasn't enough, so I built two of them. In other words, I put two layers of thickness that they had recommended. And the day before it was scheduled to be finished, a 152 came in and went through both layers and down in the bunker. So the only point I'm making is that you can only build your protection to a certain degree, and whether it's really worth going beyond 82s, 60s, and the small types, I don't know. It's something to think about. Let's see, what else you got in the note here? Patrol actions. Well, maybe this ties in with there was a general consensus of opinion, which was incidentally built not by military people but by the press media, that we never patrolled, that we were hemmed in, and we had nowheres to go but to sit in our holes. And of course, this was, you people here were probably reading the dispatches, this was not altogether true. I'd be kind of fabricating the truth if I said that we could go out in all areas of the perimeter and go out, because that would be an out and out lie. There were areas that they were in, particularly down in the Arvin area and over by 19, which was on the southwest portion of the perimeter, where they were working in fairly close to us. But on the other hand, we had a drop zone, and the only place a drop zone could go was outside the perimeter. So it meant that we had to go out every day and patrol beyond the drop zone, also put outposts and listening posts out there to make sure that we get our drops uninterrupted, at least by small arms, for sure. So we always went out in that direction. And then a point which always was of great concern to me, the water supply was located outside the perimeter. And we always, matter of fact, we'd go out there and we started pulling in the pump every night, and we'd go out and put the pump out there every day and put a listening post maybe 300-400 meters outside it, and or a small patrol in order to make sure they didn't come in while we were pumping water. So we weren't really completely hemmed in. Certainly, during the when they moved in close, our patrolling actions were limited, and this was by choice, really, because the instructions from above were that that we were to fight a set piece battle, and that I was not to get myself involved in something that would take forces from the defensive areas that I had in order to extricate them. So consequently, patrols went out only so far as they could make contact. When they made contact, they tried to estimate the size of the force and come back in. So our patrolling actions were really small probes of a nature, just seeing where the enemy was and locating them. Close air support, and as far as Quezon went, I think I can say almost unequivocally that I don't know of a time when we didn't get adequate. There were times we didn't get all we asked for, but maybe our asking was unreasonable. When you're in a situation like that, you'll take anything they'll give you, and then you ask for about 10 more. But the other thing is, as you relate it to the requesting system, we were in a unique situation. We could have anything we wanted. We had a DAS, and we had an Air Force liaison team with us. If for any reason our DAS could not get the required number of flights, of Marine flights for that day, we just turned to the Air Force liaison people. They went to the airborne DAS, and then the Air Force provided them. Now, the DAS was controlling our air coming into the area, and as I say, we got basically all we wanted. When the system changed in Vietnam, whereby the Air Force, what do they call it, single management system, is that what it is? Mm-hmm. When the single management system came in, I was upset until I read the whole message. And in the last paragraph of it, or near the last paragraph of it, it had a statement that these procedures apply to all of Vietnam except Quezon. And Quezon will remain exactly as it was. So consequently, we didn't experience any trouble with air support until it came to the 29th of the, what was it, the 30 days of September, April, June, and November. Well, about the 30th of April, the 29th to the 30th of April, when Operation Pegasus started, then we became a part of, or came under control of General Tolson, 1st Air Cav Division. And at this time, we did experience a difference. And I think the difference is, if I can just take a second and relate them. Now, I think one thing you have to equate this, in all fairness, since it's an all-Marine audience, is that prior to this time, you have to remember that we had probably number one priority in Vietnam. General Mohmeyer came to Quezon and said, if you want 1,000 sorties a day, I'll give them to you. Well, there were times that he didn't quite make his 1,000, and sometimes he had trouble making 50. But nevertheless, the hierarchy of the highest ranking officer in Vietnam was willing to back us. So that now when the system changed, then also I feel that the priority for Quezon changed because there were more forces coming into it. Taking that as a background, then I would say basically that a time of request for an on-call mission just about doubled. Now, we got an echelon of command interposed in between us, and about this time PCV came in, so maybe there's two echelons of command interposed, I don't know. pre-planned strikes had, under the single management system, had two faults with it. One was that the paperwork involved in it, I don't know how many times full it was. All I know is that we had to take and we had to increase the watch hours for the few people that you have in your regimental air section, and we had to increase our hours from, 12 to 16 hours, and also pull guys off radios and let guys double up on radios, just to take care of the paperwork involved. Now, on the pre-planned missions, at the time that I was there, and I only operated under this system, I might add, for a period of about 14 days from the end of March, and I guess I should correct the record to say that it was the end of March, not the end of April, we came under this system, and then about the 14th of April, I left Quezon. But the period I operated under, the rules at that time were that if you wanted a strike, a pre-planned strike, that you could have it the next night. In other words, we were supposed to have them in at 1700, and we didn't always make 1700, but we always made sure we got them in before 2100 at night. If you wanted a pre-planned strike, you could have it the next night, following the night that you put it in as a TPQ strike. And I might add, interject here, that I have nothing but the highest praise for the ASRAT people and the TPQ strikes. They were a real potent factor in the defense of Quezon. Or you could have the strike the day following the night. In other words, roughly 48 hours afterwards. Well, I don't know how you feel about it, but to me, as a regimental commander, I would hope that I am more on top of the situation than to have a 48-hour lag and have things be what I want them to be 48 hours hence. In other words, at the regiment, I think you should be more responsive. Your air should be more responsive than 48 hours. This of course, I feel, took away from some of the intelligence because, in my experience anyway, at Quezon, the enemy didn't stand still to wait for you to hit him, including his CPs. In other words, he moved around constantly. His forces moved around, except for those forces which were dug in close to the perimeter. All other forces were moving daily, as the sensors would tell us. So that you might take the strike, and sometimes what we do is try to beat the game by putting in a request for the strike and getting the aircraft, and then when the aircraft came to come on station, then we'd say we got another mission for you. It didn't always work, the fact is that, to me, 48 hours is an unrealistic, not responsive to the regimental commander's desires. And also, another thing that it led to, at least I feel it led to it, and this is a personal opinion, we had not had a single missed drop. In other words, every place we had asked for bombs and aircraft to attack had been attacked, and we hadn't had any thing fall in friendly lines. 5 days after, I think it was on the 5th of April, or 5th or 7th of April, very short time after the system started, we had, I probably shouldn't quote numbers, but I think if I remember correctly, it was 26 500-pound bombs drop on 1-9. Probably another story for the ordnance officer, but of the 26 bombs, not a single one went off, and not a single casualty do we have, thank God. But the fact that the bombs did get on friendly lines was, in my estimation, the result of the system whereby you put in so far ahead. Actually, what had happened is that the bombs had been requested there 48 hours before. 24 hours later, 1-9 had made greater contact. They had taken their objective and were on the objective. And so 24 hours before the strike was going to be held, a cancellation was put in. saying, don't hit this target because we've got friendly troops made their objective and they're on the objective. Somewheres in the system, one of the echelons of command that all this thing has to go through failed to notify people, and consequently the bombs dropped. As I say, it was an experience learned well and with no casualties, which is always a godsend to any commander. When the I guess that's my comments on air support. FSCC, a regiment in a situation such as we were faced with, does not have the people with the technology and the different types of things that we were given the advantage of having, does not have the people to run the FSC properly and target properly. Thank God this was seen, and I didn't even have to request the additional people. General Tompkins just automatically, when this thing started funneling people into me. And I built a TAO section, really, target information section. They were needed. I couldn't have done the job properly, I don't feel, with the people I had unless I'd have had this TAO section. Also tied in with the TAIO was the sensor program, and without people to augmentation to the two section to feed the information coming in from the sensors, I feel it would have fallen down there. So basically, if the regiment is alone like that and they have the new devices, sensors and other stuff like that, you've got to, I don't see how you can operate without augmentation of some kind. You could operate, I probably set the record straight, you could operate, but you couldn't operate properly. You wouldn't get maximum advantage out of what you had. Something would have to give, because there's only 24 hours a day, and some of the people in the regimental staff were working, I guess, 20 or 22 of them, and some days 24 of them. And unless you can do this, as you all well know, you can do this for a short time, but you don't keep it up indefinitely before your people start to go downhill and lose effectiveness. So you need additional people just to target. I feel that the FSCC played an extremely vital role in the defense of Quezon, contrary to the Air Force film that Dick is talking about. Artillery played an important role, and certainly I think that due credit in any discussion of this thing should be given to the 175 guns which were located at the rock pile, which is a real fine weapon. Normally you think of a heavy caliber weapon like that as not being accurate, but there were times when that was brought in really close. And I guess we shouldn't take away from the B-52 strike, because heaven only knows that they were a real fine adjunct. But I think what has to be kept in proper perspective is the fact that they were an adjunct and that they did perform a fine job. As you probably know, there was some kind of a directive which said that you needed some kind of high approval to come within 3,000 meters of your friendly front lines with the B-52 strikes. We came in and were during the height when they were really trying to close the base. We came within 1,000 meters. I don't know of a single case where I could question their accuracy. Naturally, I didn't observe the deep strikes. When I say deep, I'm talking 4,000 or 5,000 meters from the base. But as far as the close strikes, those 1,000 meters, they were always on target. And as far as worry about caving in of bunkers, I must say that before I made the first one, and I did a lot of soul searching as to whether I should bring them that close, whether I was going to cave in my own bunkers. Certainly, you knew they were there, and you got pretty good shockwaves. But and I know of no case where a bunker went in because of the closeness of the B-52 strikes. I think at the same time when we're talking of accuracy of bombing, that as I said earlier, I couldn't say enough for the Azrats. As far as I'm concerned, the Azrats, and I'm ashamed to say that I can't even remember the designation of which one it was, but anything but the highest praise would not be enough. The accuracy of those things was phenomenal. I know at one point, every once in a while they'd rotate people, and when they'd rotate these people, then we'd run a strike on a hilltop somewhere near us to get find out how these new people and how accurate they were. And as I remember it now, the first time we ran an accuracy check, I think they were 40 meters off. Then a couple times after that, the error was practically negligible. I mean, you couldn't tell if it was off or not because it was hitting somewheres within such a close proximity of the target that to estimate if they were off or on was it. I think probably it's interesting. I had the Air Force liaison officer in, and they had asked, the FSCC came over and asked if they could come in to 100 meters. Well, the normal procedure is, I think it's 500 is supposed to be safe. And so, rather to get a feeling from people who are familiar with it, I called in the Air Force liaison officer, who happened to be a major, and I said, hey, Major, how close would you let this Azrat bring in us? How close would you let Azrats bring in strikes to your front lines? And his comment to me was that he said, I'll be honest with you, if I were in a hole and I were in a spot, he said, with this particular Azrat, not with any Azrat, but with this particular Azrat, I wouldn't hesitate to come within 30 meters. Well, I'm afraid I just didn't have the moxie to do that, and I limited myself to about 300 meters. In other words, I didn't bring him in, because I figured that in closer than 300 meters, this is what artillery's for, and there's no reason they can't do the job. But I just point out that the Azrats were phenomenally accurate and did a wonderful job, and I have nothing but the highest praise for them. And we tied in, FSCC-wise now, we tied in after a B-52 strike, for example, we'd wait maybe 5-10 minutes, and then we'd have it all targeted and registered, maybe because we fired so many rounds that we had nearly every area on the map plotted. After the B-52 strike, we'd wait 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'd bring in the 175 guns, the 155s, the 105s, and we'd plaster it, mix VT and everything else, hoping to catch them above the ground. So when the time came to evaluate who did the real damage, I defy anybody to say that air did it or artillery did it or who did it, because everything was coordinated, and I'd like to think of it as a joint effort and a completely organized and effective supporting arms thing. Well, to move on to logistic support, I took over in Quezon about the 10th of August, and Route 9, which led from really from Fubai over into the Quezon area, was out from Kelu right down to Quezon. It never was in except about 2 days of my whole tenure, and that's after Operation Pegasus started. The route was open when the engineers made a major effort to come through there and open it. So that the whole time I was there, 8 months or 9 months, whatever it was, we relied upon air support to do it. Of course, this was a major problem, since the airstrip, although it had been redone just before I got there, had not been a rock base type thing, and consequently, when we got the first rains, the airstrip just went to pot, and they said we can't come in that way anymore. So one day, General Hochmuth walked up, and he said, "We need a rock base, Dave." And I said, "Yes, sir, we sure do." He said, "Find me rock." So we did, not me, but I had an exploring party go out, and we found a rock, which really the top of a hill, some 1,500 meters outside the base, and scooped off the top of it and made rock and rebuilt the airstrip with a rock base, and it held up pretty well. It still had some deficiencies in it because I think we had a 200 or 300 foot strip that they tried some fancy stuff with by not putting rock in but putting burlap and soaking it with tar or something, and this just didn't hack it. You needed the rock base, and it was as simple as that. Then when it really got going tough and the planes decided that they shouldn't make landing, we went to an airdrop system. And it's a wonder. We used every asset that we had at Quezon to build the airstrip. This meant artillery trucks were used to haul stuff, engineers' trucks were used to haul stuff, and that type of gear really wasn't designed to be used that way, and consequently we had a high deadline rate, and I'm sure we went through trucks that needed replacing right after the Quezon bit was over. This, of course, affected us a little bit later on when we needed to airdrop in, and we needed the rough terrain forklifts and the trucks to haul the gear from the drop zone back into the base. And it caused some problems, and many times what had happened would have to be loaded by hand, and loading 55-gallon drums is not the easiest thing to do by hand. I have been a firm believer in the rough terrain forklift since I was a battalion commander, and if there's one essential piece of equipment in the Marine Corps that I would give my wholehearted backing to, it's a rough terrain forklift. It proved it again at Quezon. It's just an outstanding, versatile vehicle that we certainly need. We tried other systems at Quezon, or I say we, really, the Air Force and Marine Air, in that we used the low-altitude parachute extraction system. And also we tried and I can't remember the name of it now, we tried a system where it's like a resting gear on an aircraft where you drop it and it hooks the resting gear. That worked pretty well. We didn't try it many times, and we really, because we were under fairly heavy shelling at the time, I don't think we installed it completely properly, because the first couple times they dropped, they just pulled the damn gear right out of the ground and we had to put it in again. However, I feel sure that if the system were properly installed, that it would be a real fine system. As far as the LAPE system goes, it by far is the most accurate system. The problem with it being that you've got to have that plane coming in, if you're not familiar with it, really has to touch. He just about touches his wheel and then he takes off again. So unless you've got a fairly flat surface, you really can't use it. But when they told me that they'd put it on a 25-meter square, they weren't kidding. They keep it only one time, and unfortunately we lost a man because of it. They dropped at the end near some bunkers, and the thing got a good head of steam on, and the guy missed his target a little bit, and it went off the end of the runway and into a bunker. But ordinarily, I'd say, from my experience, 99 hundred times out of 1,000, it's going to be where you ask it to be, except that you need this flat ground to put it on. We logistically, I think we were real well supported, and certainly everybody was cognizant of our needs and gave us what we wanted. Sometimes the hills got a little short. This was a weather problem. I don't know of any time on the base that we didn't have chow or we didn't have ammunition, which are, to me, the two basic commodities of fighting. On the hills, I don't know of any time that they were really short of ammo. Sometimes chow got short. You got to remember that I can remember we had a man shot on Hill 950 on the Marine Corps birthday, and we didn't get him. We didn't get him off the hill. Thank God he wasn't seriously hurt. We didn't get him off until the 21st of November. Now, this is how bad the weather is. In other words, the weather socked that thing in. There was no helicopters getting there for, 11 days. And this presented a problem somewhat. But basically, logistically, we were pretty well taken care of for the necessities. There were times when we lacked mail and PX supplies, but you can live without those. Intelligence-wise, I'd have to say that without the sensors, I think that we'd have been a little bit blind as to what was going on in the rear. North Vietnamese are nobody's fool. As far as I'm concerned, they're excellent at camouflage and deception. Some of the units were real fine units and others of them were lousy units, and the lousy units showed up and the real fine units showed up. But generally speaking, he could pretty well camouflage his activities. Now, when the sensors went in, it gave us a feel. We had ideas where he was, and we used the sensors for targeting, and we used them to make our plans on as to where he was and what he was going to do. The problem, as I see it, with the sensors is right now is that that we unfortunately were unable to validate their findings. In other words, maybe the fact that we never we took five fairly good sized attacks. When I say fairly good sized, I'm talking battalion sized attacks. And some of these were struck ahead of time with the supporting arms, but many times there could have been attacks being generated which the sensors had tipped us to that we fired on that were disrupted and unable to make the attack. However, we never got there right after that to find out if it was in fact true. So as far as the sensor program goes, I would just tickle to death with them, and I probably was one of the ones that couldn't believe that this thing could possibly work this way, but I'm a firm believer in it. If nothing else, it sure helped my ease, my mind to think that I had an idea where he was and where he was coming, and it validated where I thought he was going to come from. In other words, he followed certain patterns which I figured he would do, and I had positioned my forces to meet this. Now I think what we've got to do is we've got to refine them to give us just a little bit more information, and we've got to validate that when the sensor says this, that what is there? What did you read that sensor out as medium? Was medium? Were there 50, 100, or 200 there? Were there five there? Was it a bunch of elephants? Was it a bunch of quail? Or was it a deer? What was it? In other words, how valid are the results coming out of the sensors? When we do this, and then it is proved to be right, then I think we've got a real fine instrument of war, real fine. Certainly, and to take nothing away from the recon people, but certainly the recon people in Vietnam, in my experience was I spent more time trying to get them out of trouble than the information I was getting, because of the fact the OPs at Khe Sanh were limited in visibility because of the heavy grass and the undergrowth and the jungle and everything else. So they had limited views. They could only be in one spot at one time. The sensors can be in many spots at one time, and I don't have to risk a helicopter to get them out if they get detected. So I think there's a real place in it, and I think the only thing we've got to do is validate what they're telling us as being right, maybe train some people, and this is important. You've got to train some people ahead of time as to what this thing's capability is, how it should be used. Now this, if I can digress onto another subject, which does with education, we needed, when the sensor program came in, and maybe I should have known, but let's say I didn't know, what its capability was, how I should use it, and all the factors about it. The same thing was true of Cofram munitions. When the time came that they said, you are going to use this, now make good use of it, but remember, it's something special. I had never been given privy to the fact of what Cofram was, and I'm a full colonel in the Marine Corps. Now, I knew basically something about it. I think I'd be lying if I say I didn't know something about it. But when I asked for somebody to come down and give me the scoop, I finally got a brigadier general from out of, what's the Army school, Fort Sill, and he's the guy that came in and briefed me and my staff as to how to use it. Now, maybe this type of munitions has to be kept this secret, but you can't really make me believe it. Or maybe I didn't pay attention to something that was told to me years ago. But anyway, there was nobody in Quezon, really, who knew how it should be used, how it should be fired, what the limitations of it were, what the advantages of it were, what was a good target, what wasn't a good target for it. And I think, just off the top of my head, I think that these special things, we've got to spread around a little bit. I feel almost the same way about another subject that we can't talk about, but we won't get into that. I'm talking about special intelligence, and I've been on this now for 10 years, and I still feel the same. Enemy tactics and techniques. I don't know that there were any particularly new tactics or techniques that which were developed. I think when the attacks came, I think it's fairly standard. You probably all witnessed it when you were in Vietnam, is that we got the RPG attacks on the bunkers. And on some of the hills, the kids never would stay in the bunkers because they knew that when the attack started, that was the first thing going to go out. I think that they were, in my estimation, and maybe it's an important point, is that they were particularly effective along our wire until the NODs came in. And when we got the NODs, our kills at night, people along the wire went right up. And conversely, I guess, the number of times that he came on our wires went down. After a while, he learned that you just couldn't fool with the wire. Prior to the time we had the NODs, they would fool around the wire, and they many times would get on the wire. We developed a couple systems. One we tried that seemed to work fairly effectively was, a matter of fact, it came from being an old farm boy, I guess, the electric fence type thing for the cows. We hooked up radio batteries and wrapped the strand of wire around one of the wires we figured they'd have to cut to get through, and it light up a light bulb in the company CP. And when the guy cut the wire, the light bulb went out, and the company commander knew somebody was on the wire somewhere. He didn't know where, but he knew there was somebody on the wire, and therefore he could alert his forces and get ready. But and I'm sure that down in the companies they may have had additional things. That's just one that I happen to think of offhand. But the NODs did prove effective, and in my estimation, the number of instances on the wire went down appreciably once we had killed a few and they realized that they couldn't get on the wire and bother us. morale, I just, personally, I couldn't have been prouder of the unit. It's amazing what small unit leadership will do to keep morale up. The small units, I don't believe I ever went around the perimeter that even in when the heaviest bombardment was going on, that the kids weren't in good spirit. I shouldn't use kids. When the Marines weren't in good spirits, and I saw nothing detrimental to morale at all at Quezon. Casualties, we had our share, and proportionately, as they gained experience, the casualties got less. When they realized that there's a tendency on the part of all Marines, and I'm sure you've seen it in your careers, is that sometimes they start to get impervious to the fact, and they take the fatalist attitude that I'll just walk down the street, and if it hits me, it hits me. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And particularly if there's been a lull for an hour or two, you see guys with their flak jackets off and helmets off and walking down the street. And when they do, and 9 chances out of 10, they get hurt. It's a constant problem. It has been for years. It's nothing new. About the only answer is leadership. In other words, you constantly harp on them. The leaders wear their flak jackets, and the flak jacket, as far as I'm concerned, I went on a few patrols myself, and I know that the weather at Quezon was fairly cool. But I knew if I had to go somewhere where that temperature got up to 100, 110, you'd go a long day to try to get me to wear a flak jacket. Yet, and I say this knowing that the flak jacket is a great thing. If you, as many of you probably have, seen a number of pieces in a flak jacket that didn't go through and kill a man, you soon get to know the advantages of the flak jacket. Also, the bottom part of the flak jacket is a real fine piece of gear, and it would save many a guy a lot of problems. But they just don't wear it. It impedes their movement, so it's a problem. And the commander has a big decision to make. Is he gonna take a chance with heat casualties and restricting his movement, or is he gonna take a chance and take the casualties because they don't have flak jackets? And I think this is a problem that every commander has to solve for himself. I know personally now, I'm not saying that this is the decision I would make, but I know personally that if I had to go on any length patrol in hot weather, I would not wear a flak jacket because I wouldn't feel that I could accomplish my mission. Replacements came in fairly good. There wasn't, I don't believe there was ever a time when we couldn't get replacements in, or that we didn't get replacements in. Division looked out for us real fine, and they kept us pumped up in real good shape, and so I had really no problems with replacements. Casualties, I felt, were handled real well. In most cases, they were immediately evacuated from Quezon. We had like a triage station, Charlie Med, and they got out fairly regularly. There were cases where maybe a guy had to stay overnight, or maybe a guy, because of weather, had to stay on a hill longer than I would like to have seen him stay. But most cases, casualties were evacuated very quickly. Matter of fact, some casualties spent as long as 10 seconds at Quezon, practically. They come in the helicopter, they get hit, and go back out on the same helicopter. So that was a pretty quick evacuation. Command relationships, my normal relationship, of course, 26 Marines were OPCON to the 3rd MAR Div, and we were treated just like any other regiment, and treated very fairly, and I would have no qualms about, I was tickled to death with it. There are problems, I guess, when you look at the command relationships administrative control-wise, when you have the administrative control of a regiment setting in Okinawa, with the reports emanating from that regiment back to Okinawa, and the communications problems associated with communicating that far back. However, I guess there are implications to this which which dictate that it should be done. However, also you do not have administrative control of, I did not have any, let's put it that way, I did not have administrative control of my battalions. I had five battalions, one Arvin and four Marine. The 126, 226, 326, and 19. I guess it's probably the first time that the 26 Marines have been together since World War II. It was at Quezon because of the necessity of shuffling battalions. But I think, personally now, I feel that having the administrative control of a unit with other than its parent unit takes something away from a commander. In other words, a regimental commander is responsible for everything that his subordinates do or undertake to do or anything else. When he doesn't have administrative control of them, he has lost something which he feels a personal responsibility for. So I, as far as I'm personally concerned, although it would have been a lot more, hey, it was easy for me because all I had to say was it isn't my problem. That's somebody else's problem because they're not under my admin control. But yet you feel a certain responsibility. You inject yourself into it whether you want to or not because you feel this responsibility. And it didn't make it tough on me because I was the regimental commander and they were battalion commanders. But I have the feeling in my own mind that sometimes it may have hurt them a little bit to have me stick my foot in the administrative chain, which I presumably should not have been in. But take that for what it's worth. The press, as you well know, Quezon took on a national and maybe international flavor. Unfortunately, we live in an atmosphere of which there is free press, and these people are free to come and go as they want. And by the same token, just by a natural generation of things, commander finds himself with having to take care of him. Now, we can all say that you can let them go any way they want, and you don't have to pay much attention to them, but if you do, you're just whistling up a tree, because you do, and it takes time. And the time it takes depends upon how, I guess, you as an individual handle a situation. I was asked at one time, they said, we're going to shuttle the press in, and how many do you want there at one time? And my answer was none. Naturally, and I said so at the time, I said, I realize this is unrealistic, but you asked, so I'll tell you, none. And they said, well, can you possibly take five? And I said, yeah, I can take five, but then right away, five is no good because you don't even get the major networks in five. So you end up with 10 and eventually 15 plus what sneak in. And really with the press, I never realized really the importance of an ISO, but I think honestly you've got to say that any guy, any Marine officer who gets that job is really has a tremendous responsibility. He can sit on his duff and do nothing. But if he's good, he's going to keep you out of jail. When I say you, I mean you, the commander, out of jail. Because he has a working relationship with these people. He knows them personally. And when you go out and make some statement in the heat of combat, he's the guy that can get it straightened out for you before it becomes a national thing, which it does, believe it or not. I mean, it just, things you say, or some private says maybe, become things of national concern. So this ISO is a real important guy. He can keep him off your back. My basic technique was that I set a time each day. If they wanted to be there, they got an interview. If they didn't want to be there, they didn't get one. Well, it got to be a matter of routine, and they all showed up. So I gave up one time every day, about an hour at 11 o'clock. Every day I gave up an hour, and that was the press's time. And when it was over, if somebody else wanted, they waited till 11 o'clock the next day. unless they, sometimes they'd want a human interest story or something. You might take a little extra time, but basically it was all done in that hour. And I think as commanders, we have to realize that this is a fact of life. Probably none of us are particularly pleased with it, but it is a fact of life, and you've got to accept it. And there's problems with feeding them. You get even bigger problems with that. You get women coming. Now, what does a guy do with a woman that's taken anywhere from 300 to 1,300 rounds of artillery, mortars, and rockets a day, and is where does he keep her? What does he do with her? And this is where your ISO comes into being. He's got to take the time, and the big thing is he's got to get them out as quick as he got them in, if he can possibly do it, you know? Like, that's your story, why don't you leave this afternoon? But it is a problem, and we all face it, and it's just a fact of life, and you've got to accept it, and pray to heaven you get a good ISO that can handle a job for you. I don't know, I got anything else?
Well, it's been a real fine debrief, Dave, and I'm sure there are probably some questions from the floor, so we'll just open it up.
I don't suppose you should get in the mining business, should you?
In what?
In the nuclear preparations that you may have made. Colonel Williams has the NBC section here in G3.
If you We didn't have any plans, and had it come about, I feel that we had within the FSCC the capability, and as you know, I carry a 5715. I think I could have done it. But we never did. We heard stories that people were thinking about it, but. But we never took any stock in it because it came from all kinds of weird sources, so we never even had any plans for it. Maybe we should have, I don't know. I think I've got a couple comments on it. One is that because there are relatively